Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 29th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on condors. Then we'll move on to Valley and state news and then conclude the first hour with national and world news from USA Today. Our feature front page article is entitled Caring for Condors. The subtitle is With Threats of Avian Flu and Lead Poisoning, Biologists in Arizona Are Working Overtime to Care for a Species That Nearly Went Extinct. This is by John Leos. Marble Canyon. Nestled among Arizona's colossal vermilion cliffs, an inconspicuous building bustles with the sounds of flapping wings. Inside the remote building, no larger than a double-wide mobile home, a team of dedicated biologists works overtime to sustain one of the nation's most endangered species, the California condor. Known to the biologists as the barn, the three-room facility and attached enclosure is where wild condors are brought to receive treatment and rehabilitation from the species' biggest threat, lead poisoning. Inside the small examination room, Tim Hawk stands by a computer monitor viewing an X-ray of a California condor perched in the attached enclosure. Hawk is the director of the California Condor Recovery Program at the Peregrine Fund, the organization that's permitted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to manage the Arizona-Utah experimental population. With each scan, he meticulously looks for metal fragments that could be slowly poisoning the bird from the inside. The condor has likely ingested lead bullet fragments embedded in the remains of a dead animal caused by hunting or humane dispatch. Recent years have been busy for the condor crew as an outbreak of the highly pathogenic avian influenza, also known as HPAI or bird flu, resulted in the death of 21 condors in 2023 and set back recovery efforts by about a decade. Since then, biologists have incorporated new biosecurity measures as they respond to the persistent threat of lead poisoning. On average, the Peregrine Fund team can trap and test about 75% of the flock for lead poisoning between November and February. Last year, about half of the tested birds required treatment, slightly higher than the average of 40%, according to Hawk. Data is still being collected about how lead poisoning is affecting the flock this year. Occasionally, a condor will be treated twice within the same year, with some individuals having abnormally high amounts of the toxic metal in their digestive tracts. This is an indication that lead exposure is a regular occurrence for many of the birds, with the highest exposure periods occurring during and after the big game hunting seasons. Lead is our primary threat, said Hawk. Our number one objective is to make sure that the birds are healthy, and if they are not, getting them healthy. In addition to providing treatment, the small team of biologists spends time in the field tracking the locations of the flock, monitoring their breeding and social behaviors, and looking for signs of illness or distress. Sometimes this requires extraordinary measures, such as when the biologists hiked on foot into a remote canyon with a large animal carrier to capture condor 999 in 2022. The condor had been seriously wounded after a suspected golden eagle attack and required veterinary care from a wildlife rehabilitation center in Phoenix. The condor, known to the staff affectionately as Nines, was released back into the wild, but returned to the Vermilion Cliffs facility this year for lead poisoning treatment. Some people would write us off as whack jobs. We're crazy, right? We're more dedicated to wildlife than we are to our fellow humans, said Chris Parrish, president of the Peregrine Fund. Well, that's not true, because everything we're doing is to make sure that the future generations have it better than we found it, and I think it brings out the best. As the endangered condors enter this year's breeding season amid threats of avian flu and lead poisoning, wildlife managers are working overtime to maintain a species whose fate is closely intertwined with human activity. The plight of the condor. A California condor's presence cannot be ignored. The largest land bird in North America, an adult condor has a wingspan of almost 10 feet and can weigh up to 25 pounds. Since prehistoric times, condors have soared above much of the continent, with a modern historic range stretching from British Columbia to Baja. By the mid-20th century, the population had drastically declined due to shooting, poisoning from lead and DDT pesticide, and habitat degradation. After the passage of the Endangered Species Protection Act of 1966, the first piece of federal comprehensive endangered species legislation, the California condor was one of the first species listed in danger of extinction. By 1982, there were only 22 California condors left in the world. Wildlife managers made a dramatic decision. By 1987, every wild condor was captured and placed into a captive breeding program in an attempt to save the majestic species. This program would evolve into one of the most intensive wildlife management programs in U.S. history. Led by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the recovery program includes federal agencies in the United States and Mexico, state wildlife management agencies in Arizona, California, and Utah, and a number of zoos and nonprofit organizations, and the Yurok Tribe in Northern California. The Yurok Tribe is one of the many indigenous cultures that consider the California condor sacred, and after initiating a reintroduction program in 2008, the tribe and its federal partners began releasing condors onto Yurok Ancestral Territory and Redwood National Park in 2022. Today, there are 5 free-flying populations of California condors in North America, 3 in California, 1 in Mexico, and 1 near the border of Arizona and Utah near the Grand Canyon. In 2023, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife reported 344 California condors living in the wild, 90 of which belong to the Arizona flock. Each wild condor wears an identifying number and a tracking device, giving wildlife managers the ability to keep close tabs on the location of each individual bird. Most programs are a little bit envious of our ability to track all the condors, said Ashley Blackford, the director of the California Condor Recovery Program for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Blackford has worked on other species recovery programs for the service and acknowledged the unique heavy management of the California condor population by the recovery teams. Eventually, you want the species to be succeeding to the degree that you can't do that anymore. To be downlisted from endangered to threatened, there must be at least 2 successful wild California condor populations with at least 150 individual birds, among other goals. In the wild, a condor will reach breeding age around 6 years of age, and a breeding pair of condors will produce a single successful egg about once every 2 years. This lengthy reproductive period and high mortality caused by lead poisoning have left the condor population struggling to reach the 150-count benchmark. The goal is not to be managing the flock the way we are, said Blackford. A lot of our close management is still related to that primary threat of lead on the landscape and being able to be responsive in our management actions. Lead on the landscape. By far, the largest threat to California condors in the wild is lead poisoning. Between 1992 and 2023, lead poisoning accounted for the mortality of 137 wild condors, 48% of all known deaths, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In the Arizona-Utah population, At least 52 individual birds have died from lead poisoning since being introduced to the region in 1996. Lead bullets can break into thousands of small pieces as they enter an animal, and those fragments can be toxic to the wildlife that feed on the carcass or gut piles left behind by hunters, ranchers, or police on the landscape. When non-lead ammo is used, hunting can be a positive practice for the California condor population. Hunting provides a valuable food source for the condors because they are obligate scavengers, meaning they will only eat animals that are already dead. The Arizona Game and Fish Department has had some success removing lead from the landscape. All deer, bighorn sheep, and bison hunters who draw tags in the areas where California condors soar receive a coupon for a free or discounted box of non-lead ammunition. The department also does outreach to inform hunters of the impacts of lead ammunition on wildlife. In 2024, some 54% of successful hunters used non-lead bullets, and 28% packed out animal gut piles in condor habitat, according to Aaron Brown, the California Condor Program Coordinator at Arizona Game and Fish. Multiple challenges remain for changing the behaviors of the remaining hunters. Lead ammo can cost slightly less than the non-lead alternative, and some hunters are skeptical about its effectiveness. "We're seeing there are some folks who just are not interested," said Brown. "Lead-free ammunition has come a long way in the last several years, and I think folks still have an old mindset that it's not good for the gun or it doesn't shoot well, and that's just not accurate anymore." In 2017, the Peregrine Fund, the Oregon Zoo, and the Institute for Wildlife Studies established the North American Non-Lead Partnership, which designs and supports voluntary measures to increase the use of non-lead ammunition among all stakeholders who use firearms outdoors. This campaign has been all-inclusive in trying to share that information with wildlife managers, with law enforcement, with ranchers, and with hunters, said Parrish of the Peregrine Fund. "A lot of people would like to take this and say it's an attack against hunting. Well, no, it's not meant to be. That's how some people perceive it." In 2019, a law banning the use of lead ammunition in all types of hunting took effect in California. Despite this, lead poisoning continues to be a leading cause of death for condors in the state, claiming the lives of 7 condors in California in 2023, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife. It only takes one lead-laden carcass to poison multiple members of the flock. Known as nature's cleanup crew, the condors often feed on the same food source due to their highly social nature, and as opportunistic feeders, they take every chance to eat a carcass down to the bone. "Our goal is just to provide information to hunters, let them understand their conservation impacts and whether or not they want to choose to participate," said Brown. "And overall, as hunters continue to participate in these conservation activities, the long-term impacts of removing lead fragments from the landscape are going to extend beyond California condor recovery and just make a much bigger impact on the landscape." Avian flu outbreak adds concerns. When the California condors began acting lethargic and fatigued in the spring of 2023, the biologists believed the birds were experiencing symptoms of lead poisoning. It wasn't until after they brought them into the facility that they discovered the population had contracted the highly pathogenic avian influenza, or bird flu. For 3 weeks, the avian flu ravaged the population. The condor team was working overtime to contain the spread and treat the sick birds, often being forced to take mandatory breaks. "It was like we were losing a bird a day, so we lost 21 birds in 3 weeks," said Hawk. "When we were in it, it felt like it was a lifetime." It is still unclear how the condors initially contracted the avian flu, but the disease spread quickly due to their social nature. I wish that I had a crystal ball that could tell me how they contracted it. It seems like it was probably a fluke, and it was a rare occurrence, said Hawk. But it happened, and as soon as you get something like that, in a population of a bird like the condor, which is a gregarious species, the probability of it spreading through the population is really high. As recent cases of avian flu rise in wild birds across the country, the condor team feels better prepared to respond. An emergency vaccine was approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and 134 wild condors have been vaccinated by October 2024, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In Arizona, the biologists discovered through testing that many of the condors in the population had contracted the avian flu during the outbreak but survived. With the existing antibodies in their systems, the condor population is better protected from similar strains of the disease. In recent months, the outbreak of avian flu on dairy farms in California has become an emerging challenge for the condor recovery program, as dead calves are used as a supplemental food source for the birds. To date, we don't have a validated way to test a stillborn calf and say it's safe or it's unsafe, said Blackford of U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We're making more broad swath decisions based on infection levels in counties and what our State Department of Agriculture is advising us on. In Arizona, the Peregrine Fund's Condor team is in close communication with the group's dairy farm partner to ensure that the dead calves they provide the condors are not infected. Keeping recovery efforts burning. On the night of January 30th, only four condors received treatment, a relatively easy night for the team, who regularly care for more than a dozen birds at a time. As the biologists enter the barn, they don the coveralls hanging on the wall and swap their hiking shoes for rubber boots before two of the biologists enter the condor's enclosure with a large hand net. Each bird is brought inside one at a time. Held carefully but firmly by a team member, Hawk first checks the size of each bird's crop, a special pouch in their throat that holds food before digestion, and then administers the lead poisoning treatment. The condors undergo chelation treatment, in a process similar to what a human would receive for lead poisoning. The birds are injected every 12 hours with a chemical that removes toxic metal from their bodies on a weekly cycle. Their blood is tested periodically before the biologists determine if the condors are healthy enough to return to the wild. The work is laborious, but the crew is jovial. They know the birds on an individual level, calling them using nicknames, acknowledging their personality traits, or mentioning the similarities of the bird's parents or siblings. On the wall, a dry erase board displays the identifying number of each California condor in the population that has died, in remembrance with the message, "Keep the fire burning," written alongside. The pressure is on to get as many adult condors onto the landscape as the breeding season begins, and the slow cycle to bolster the condor population continues. In the fall, the Peregrine Fund releases California condors from its captive breeding program in Idaho into the Vermilion Cliffs population. Among the condors released in 2024 was Condor 1221, known as Milagra, Miracle in Spanish, whose story encapsulates the biologist's commitment to the species. After her mother died of avian flu and her father became sick in 2023, Milagra was collected from the wild as an egg. Defying odds through intense intervention, the egg was incubated in captivity and raised with foster parents in Idaho. This bird, by all accounts, should not even be here, and it is here because of this dedicated group of individuals that cares about the species and has made it their lifelong goal to see the species recover, said Hawk. I think that's really special. And that resonates with a lot of people. It brings people into the fold, and that's ultimately what we want to do. We want to make people look at the condor as a species worthy of being on this landscape because it almost wasn't. Last September, Malagra was released back into the Vermilion Cliffs, soaring high above a cheering crowd. She has not returned for lead poisoning treatment. And that article was entitled Caring for Condors, and that was by John Leos. Moving on now to Valley and State News, we have an article entitled Second Arizona Hospital Now Offering Lung Transplants. This is by Stephanie Innes. Mayo Clinic in Arizona has the largest organ transplant program in the state. But except for a brief period nearly a decade ago, lung transplants have been a missing component. Officials with a nonprofit medical system announced June 23rd that they'd launched a new lung transplant program, which they had been working at building for years. The health system performed 5 lung transplants in 2016, but at that time did not create a full-fledged program and has not performed any since. Mayo Clinic leaders decided, after 5 lung transplants, to put the program on hold and invest in the massive infrastructure and experts needed to build a program that would have the best possible outcomes, said Dr. Basher Ackel, who is director of the Mayo Clinic in Arizona's Transplant Center. Mayo Clinic's Phoenix Hospital has been growing its overall transplant program in recent years, from 257 transplants in 2008 to 884 in 2024, national data shows. But what was missing from the program, which also transplants hearts, livers, and kidneys, was lungs, Ackel said. We are becoming a destination transplant center for people across the U.S. and international as well, Ackel said. It was an absolute need for us to complete the portfolio and serve all our patients. We have patients with advanced lung failure, and we needed to find a pathway to get them to transplant. Both of Arizona's active lung transplant programs in Phoenix. Now, the Mayo Clinic is one of 2 hospitals in the state with active lung transplant programs. The other is Dignity Health St. Joseph's Medical Center in Phoenix, which has performed a majority of the 1,758 lung transplants that have taken place in Arizona since 1990, data through June 22nd from the U.S. Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network and the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients says. Banner University Medical Center in Tucson historically has had a lung transplant program, but it's on hiatus, Banner health officials confirmed with the Arizona Republic. So Southern Arizona residents in need of a lung transplant must travel to Phoenix unless they go out of state. The Mayo Clinic in Arizona's first patient in its newly launched program, which is for adults only, is a Fountain Hills man who had severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and got a new set of lungs May 30th. Craig Shearer, 67, was discharged from the hospital June 19th and is back at home and for the first time in years is able to live his life without needing an external oxygen tank, he told the Arizona Republic. Leaders with the Mayo Clinic in Arizona expect to do at least 10 transplants within a year, which is the number needed to earn certification for the program from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Moving forward, the hope is that the new program will perform between 25 and 35 lung transplants per year, said Dr. Jonathan DeCunha, who is chair of cardiothoracic surgery for the Mayo Clinic in Arizona and surgical director of the new lung transplant program. We pride ourselves on serious and complex care for all of our patients, and so lung transplant falls right in line with that, DeCunha said. We're really excited about being able to bring this to the patients at Mayo and those that get referred in with end-stage lung disease. Lung transplant outcomes are improving, surgeon says. Lung transplant candidate screenings for the new program began late in 2024, DeCunha said. Many of the patients referred to the program do not end up getting approved as suitable candidates for transplant, program officials said. Factors such as age, health status, anatomic issues, and behavioral, financial, and caregiver issues may also play a role, de Cunha said. Lung transplants are complex, and some states, including Nevada and New Mexico, don't have any centers that offer them. Other states, such as Colorado and Utah, have just one center performing lung transplants. The national data shows that since January 1, 1988, there have been 56,604 lung transplants performed in the United States, with the highest number in California, followed by Pennsylvania and Texas. Medical literature puts the survivability of a lung transplant at about 55% to 60% after 5 years, but de Cunha said advancements in lung transplantation and ICU practices are improving the outcomes, and he is seeing trends that are better than that. The timing of who on the waiting list is an allocation based on a scoring system that serves as a ranking, where the sickest patients have a higher priority on the waiting list when donor organs are available. Compatibility in terms of blood type and size is an important factor. Fountain Hills man waited 22 days for his new lungs. Shearer waited 22 days for his new lungs. Prior to getting his transplant, he could not complete a sentence without gasping and taking a big breath. When de Cunha first met him, Shearer had to lean forward just to breathe. Shearer doesn't know anything about the deceased donor of his lungs and is not allowed to know or contact the family of his donor right away. He eventually plans to send them a thank you letter, and it will be up to the donor's family whether they want to respond. Shearer said his mother had COPD, so it may have been an inherited condition. Another possibility is his occupation. For 4 decades, he installed flooring, which included ripping out carpets. Until he became sick, never wore a mask to protect himself from dust and other airborne particles, he said. By the time I turned 61, I had lost the ability to do my job because of my condition, Shearer said. It's a progressive disease, and it got to where I could not work at all. A father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, Shearer is looking forward to spending time with family, to taking walks without an oxygen tank, and to traveling. Patients recover to different levels, but de Cunha said Shearer is doing well. He is optimistic, and when doctors told him to walk 4 times a day postoperatively, he walked 6 times a day. That kind of effort has a good payoff in terms of recovering, de Cunha said. De Cunha, who has previously performed lung transplants in Minnesota and Pittsburgh, said he has one lung transplant patient who hiked Mount Rainier and another who runs half marathons. What I tell patients is you get a new lease on life when you get a new set of lungs, but you are trading your oxygen tank and your lack of hope for seeing a bunch of doctors and taking a bunch of pills. That's the trade-off, de Cunha said. As time goes on, it gets much easier for patients to manage that. Shearer will be on anti-rejection medications for the rest of his life and needs to be much more careful than before about preventing skin cancer, among other precautions. But he says his life now is 1,000% different than it was before his transplant. I have a life. I can look to tomorrow now, he said. It's hard to describe. I have a new life, and there's so much I want to do. There's not one thing in particular. Just having options is wonderful. And that article is entitled Second Arizona Hospital Now Offering Lung Transplants. And that was by Stephanie Innes. We're approximately 29 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 29th, 2025. We're going to turn now to a section of the paper entitled Trump's Ongoing Impact on Arizona, with this article entitled 14 million acres of federal land in state could go up for sale. This is by Stephanie Innes. President Donald Trump's administration touched all parts of Arizona this week, from the southern border to the Colorado River. And on the international stage, the president rattled the world over the June 21st to 22nd weekend by intervening in the conflict between Israel and Iran, Trump ordered airstrikes on 3 Iranian nuclear facilities. Beyond the escalation against Iran, the White House made several other recent moves that directly impacted Arizona. The Trump administration awarded a new contract to shore up the wall at the Arizona-Mexico border and tapped an Arizonan to lead the federal agency that manages water in the West. Meanwhile, Arizona public land advocates are worried over a provision in the Big Beautiful Bill of Trump policy priorities that would make 14 million acres of federal land in Arizona eligible for sale. Plus, Trump's mass deportation push continues across the country. An Arizona federal judge is preparing to hear a request for a nationwide injunction on a deportation case. And a recent incident at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles is raising questions among baseball fans about what would happen if Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents appeared at Chase Field. Arizona company lands border wall contract. An Arizona company will soon build 27 miles of border wall at the Arizona-Mexico border. It's the second border wall construction contract to be awarded since Trump's second term began. Fisher Sand and Gravel Company will receive $309 million from U.S. Customs and Border Protection to build 27 miles of border wall in the Tucson sector of the U.S.-Mexico border over the next 2.5 years. The project will close critical openings in the border wall, CBP said. Former President Joe Biden halted the construction of the border wall during his term. Fisher Sand and Gravel Company has worked on a number of projects at the Arizona-Mexico border and in other states like New Mexico and Texas. The firm has been awarded approximately $2 billion in wall contracts. 14 million Arizona acres could be sold under Senate bill. Sabino Canyon and Mount Lemmon could go up for sale if a Republican-backed spending bill passes the Senate. It's part of the Big Beautiful Bill of Trump priorities that the GOP is trying to pass this summer. A provision in the legislation would make millions of acres of public land eligible for sale. In Arizona, 14 million acres of public land that are owned by the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service could be eligible for sale. The proposed amendment says that the land must be used for housing or housing-related infrastructure, but it's vague on how long the housing use requirement would apply once the land changes hands. The provision is not limited to affordable housing. Nationally, some 250 million acres of public land meet the bill's criteria for sale across 11 western states, according to the nonprofit Wilderness Society. National parks, monuments, and wildernesses are excluded. Ice at Chase Field. Incident at Dodger Stadium raises questions. After Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents were reported at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, some Arizonans are wondering whether ICE could show up at Chase Field in Phoenix. Los Angeles has been a flashpoint in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Protests broke out after ICE conducted worksite raids in Los Angeles, and Trump later deployed the National Guard and U.S. Marines to the city. ICE has also been active in the Phoenix area, sparking protests. The Trump administration is pushing to make good on the president's campaign promise of mass deportations. The Arizona Diamondbacks did not say how they'd respond if federal agents showed up at the ballpark in Phoenix. Maricopa County, which owns the stadium property, also declined to comment. Arizona Democrats warn of Iran escalation. As Trump weighed whether to join Israel's conflict with Iran, a Democrat who represents Arizona in Washington, D.C., moved to limit the president's power. First-term Representative Yasemin Ansari, Democrat of Arizona, signed on to a resolution aimed at limiting Trump's power to involve the United States in the Middle Eastern conflict. Ansari warned that tensions in the region could escalate and U.S. troops could be endangered if Trump authorizes strikes on Iran. Ansari, who's Iranian-American, also said Iran can never be allowed to obtain nuclear capabilities. After the U.S. strikes, Ansari returned to social media. Donald Trump illegally took military action against Iran without congressional authority, risking dragging us into another endless war, Ansari wrote June 21st. I am calling for an immediate emergency session of Congress to vote on the War Powers Resolution. Trump announced June 23rd that Israel and Iran had agreed to a ceasefire after Iran retaliated against a U.S. base in Qatar. Arizona judge to hear asylum case. An Arizona federal judge will hear an Iranian asylum seeker's request for a nationwide injunction to stop the Trump administration from deporting her. It may also protect thousands of other people in similar situations. The Trump administration has continued to use a method to remove people from the country that is likely unlawful and is doing so by evading judicial review, according to U.S. District Judge G. Murray Snow. Iranian Fatima Tabeta Biafar, 22, made an asylum claim after being detained in February. Officials assessed it under an international human rights treaty called the Convention Against Torture, which carries a higher standard to stay in the country than an asylum claim does. Her lawyer argues that the Convention Against Torture was the wrong standard to apply to her case, and that the immigration official failed to notify Tabeta Biafar that she had a right to request an immigration judge review her case. Snow agreed with Tabeta Biafar's lawyer and scheduled a June 23rd hearing on the nationwide injunction. Arizona man to head water board. The federal agency that manages water in the West is on track to be run by an Arizonan. Trump nominated Ted Cook to lead the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. The Bureau oversees water resource management and delivers 10 trillion gallons of water to millions of people each year. It's also seeking a negotiated deal to share the Colorado River's water among 7 western states. Cook is the former general manager of the Central Arizona Project, the 336-mile system that supplies Colorado River water to the most populated regions in Arizona. And that article was entitled, 14 million acres of Trump federal land in state could go up for sale. And that was under a section in the paper entitled Trump's Ongoing Impact on Arizona. Our next article is entitled APS is Sending Some Money Back to Its Customers. This is by Sasha Hupka. Arizona Public Service Company customers will soon see a discount on their summer utility bills. The electric company, which serves about 1.4 million homes and businesses statewide, is sending a total of $52 million back to its ratepayers after it overcollected on a fee that funds clean energy projects and energy efficiency programs. That means the average customer will see $10 off their power bill in July and August. That's typically the hottest part of the summer, when utility bills are highest for most Arizonans. Here's what to know about the savings and how it could impact your power bill. Where will I see the discount? The reduction will be automatically applied to the environmental benefits surcharge on your power bill. Only customers who pay that fee are eligible to receive the discount. How much could customers save? The savings are based on energy use. That means that a customer using more power on a monthly basis will receive a larger reduction than one using less. The average residential customer will see a discount of about $10 on their July and August bills. APS defines that typical customer as using about 1,050 kilowatt hours of electric in a month. Why is APS giving money back? The utility is seeing more money collected through the environmental benefits surcharge than usual. That's partly because its customer base is growing as more people and businesses move to Arizona. Plus, desert summers are getting hotter and longer, prompting increased energy usage. Certain programs that allow customers to pay an extra fee to opt into receiving clean energy, such as the utility's Green Choice program and Green Power Partners, have also proven popular. That creates revenue that can then flow back to customers. Will it continue after August? No. This is a one-time refund. APS does offer other tools that can help customers save. That includes various plans to help customers lower their electric bills in line with their energy usage habits and rebates for those who take steps to make their homes more energy efficient. How will my bill change in the future? APS is currently asking its regulators to approve a $579 million rate increase, an overall 14% bump. The utility is also asking permission to adjust its prices annually under a streamlined rate-setting process and alter its rate design to establish new requirements for data centers and other industrial customers that use vast amounts of energy. That request would bump the average residential customer's monthly bill by about $20. Utility officials said inflation, high interest rates, and supply chain volatility are driving up the cost of service. Economic growth, increased wildfire risk, and extreme heat are also necessitating further utility investment in the energy grid. New rates, if approved, would become effective in mid-2026 at the earliest. What if I can't pay my bill? APS offers assistance options for those struggling to pay their power bill. That includes crisis bill assistance, discounts for low-income customers, and payment arrangements. There are also state and federal programs that may be able to help, such as the Low-Income Housing and Energy Assistance Program. Some nonprofit agencies provide utility payment assistance. Many also offer eviction prevention funds and contribute to a network of heat relief centers across the state. To get help, contact APS at 602-371-7171 or call the state's Human Services Hotline at 211. That article is entitled, APS is Sending Some Money Back to Its Customers, and that was by Sasha Hupka. This next article is entitled, Valley Tops Nation in 2024 Home Building. This is by Rhea Lee. If you've noticed new homes and apartments popping up around the valley at an unusual rate, you're not alone. Maricopa County led the nation in new housing built in 2024, according to census data released on May 15th. The county added 38,310 housing units last year, beating out Los Angeles County and Harris County, Texas, which both added about 32,000 units. Builders in Maricopa County constructed significantly more homes, apartments, and mobile homes than the rest of Arizona. The next largest increase in housing units in the state came from Pima County, which added 5,800. Building new housing has been a major goal for Arizona, as cities across the state face a shortage of affordable housing. Tucson's government said in its 2024 housing report that the city needs to add 35,000 new homes in the next decade to meet demand. In February, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego announced that Phoenix has built or saved 50,000 new units since 2020, a 2030 housing goal reached 5 years early. Whether the rapid rate of construction will continue in 2025 is unclear, as builders face the threat of tariffs on construction materials such as lumber from Canada, as well as increased development fees in Phoenix. In March, home building dipped 20% compared with March 2024. That article was entitled, Valley Tops Nation in 2024 Home Building, and that was by Rhea Lee. We're going to move on now to articles from USA Today on national and world news, with two front-page articles, one on the Supreme Court and migrants, and the second front-page article on Iran. The first article is entitled, Migrants Rush to Get Legal Clarity, with the subtitle, Ruling Causes Confusion Over Status of Birthright Citizenship. This is by Ted Hessen and Christina Cook. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruling tied to birthright citizenship prompted confusion and phone calls to lawyers as people who could be affected tried to process a convoluted legal decision with major humanitarian implications. The court's conservative majority on June 27th granted President Donald Trump his request to curb federal judges' power, but did not decide the legality of his bid to restrict birthright citizenship. That outcome has raised more questions than answers about a right long understood to be guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution, that anyone born in the United States is considered a citizen at birth, regardless of their parents' citizenship or legal status. Lorena, a 24-year-old Colombian asylum seeker who lives in Houston and is due to give birth in September, pored over media reports on June 27th. She was looking for details about how her baby might be affected, but said she was left confused and worried. "There are not many specifics," said Lorena, who, like others interviewed by Reuters, asked to be identified by her first name out of fear for her safety. "I don't understand it well." She is concerned that her baby could end up with no nationality. "I don't know if I can give her mine," she said. "I also don't know how it would work if I can add her to my asylum case. I don't want her to be adrift with no nationality." Trump issued an order after taking office in January that directed U.S. agencies to refuse to recognize the citizenship of children born in the United States who do not have at least one parent who is an American citizen or lawful permanent resident. The order was blocked by three separate U.S. District Court judges, sending the case on a path to the Supreme Court. The resulting decision said Trump's policy could go into effect in 30 days, but appeared to leave open the possibility of further proceedings in the lower courts that could keep the policy blocked. On the afternoon of June 27th, plaintiffs filed an amended lawsuit in federal court in Maryland seeking to establish a nationwide class of people whose children could be denied citizenship. If they are not blocked nationwide, the restrictions could be applied in the 28 states that did not contest them in court, creating an extremely confusing patchwork across the country, according to Kathleen Bush Joseph, a policy analyst for the Nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Would individual doctors, individual hospitals be having to try to figure out how to determine the citizenship of babies and their parents, she said. The drive to restrict birthright citizenship is part of Trump's broader immigration crackdown, and he has framed automatic citizenship as a magnet for people to come to give birth. "Hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into our country under birthright citizenship, and it wasn't meant for that reason," he said during a White House press briefing on June 27th. Worried calls. Immigration advocates and lawyers in some Republican-led states said they received calls from a wide range of pregnant immigrants and their partners following the ruling. They were grappling with how to explain it to clients who could be dramatically affected, given all the unknowns of how future litigation would play out or how the executive order would be implemented state by state. Lynn Tremont, director of the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, said she got a call on June 27th from an East Asian temporary visa holder with a pregnant wife. He was anxious because Ohio is not one of the plaintiff states and wanted to know how he could protect his child's rights. He kept stressing that he was very interested in the rights included in the Constitution, she said. Advocates underscored the gravity of Trump's restrictions, which would block an estimated 150,000 children born in the United States annually from receiving automatic citizenship. "It really creates different classes of people in the country with different types of rights," said Juliana Macedo do Nascimento, a spokesperson for the immigrant rights organization United We Dream. "That is really chaotic." Adding uncertainty, the Supreme Court ruled that members of two plaintiff groups in the litigation, CASA, an immigrant advocacy service in Maryland, and the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, would still be covered by lower court blocks on the policy. Whether someone in a state where Trump's policy could go into effect could join one of the organizations to avoid the restrictions, or how state or federal officials would check for membership remained unclear. Betsy, a U.S. citizen who recently graduated from high school in Virginia and a CASA member, said both of her parents came to the United States from El Salvador 2 decades ago and lacked legal status when she was born. I feel like it targets these innocent kids who haven't even been born, she said, declining to give her last name for concerns over her family's safety. Navita, a Honduran asylum seeker in Louisiana, is a member of the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project and recently gave birth. She heard on June 27th from a friend without legal status who's pregnant and wonders about the situation under Louisiana's Republican governor, since the state is not one of those fighting Trump's order. She called me very worried and asked, "What's going to happen?" she said. "If her child is born in Louisiana, is the baby going to be a citizen?" And that article is entitled, "Migrants Rush to Get Legal Clarity," and that was by Ted Hessen and Christina Cook. And now the second front page article from USA Today is entitled, "Iran Holds Funeral for Slain Commanders, Scientists." The subtitle is, "Crowds Mourn Those Killed in War with Israel." This is by Reuters staff. Large crowds of mourners dressed in black lined the streets in Iran's capital, Tehran, as the country held a funeral on June 28th for top military commanders, nuclear scientists, and some of the civilians killed during the aerial war with Israel. At least 16 scientists and 10 senior commanders were among those mourned at the funeral, according to state media, including Armed Forces Chief Major General Mohammed Bagheri, Revolutionary Guard Commander General Hossein Salami, and Guard Aerospace Force Chief General Amir Ali Hajizadeh. Their coffins were driven into Tehran's Azadi Square, adorned with their photos and national flags, as crowds waved flags and some reached out to touch the caskets and throw rose petals onto them. State-run press TV showed an image of ballistic missiles on display. Mass prayers were later held in the square. State TV said the funeral, dubbed the Procession of the Martyrs of Power, was held for a total of 60 people killed in the war, including 4 women and 4 children. In attendance were President Masoud Pezeshkian and other senior figures, including Ali Shamkhani, who was seriously wounded during the conflict, and an advisor to Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, as well as Khamenei's son Mojtaba. Today, Iranians, through heroic resistance against 2 regimes armed with nuclear weapons, protected their honor and dignity and looked to the future prouder, more dignified, and more resolute than ever, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, who also attended the funeral, said in a Telegram post. There was no immediate statement from Khamenei, who has not appeared publicly since the conflict began. In past funerals, he led prayers over the coffins of senior commanders ahead of public ceremonies. Israel launched the air war on June 13th, attacking Iranian nuclear facilities and killing top military commanders as well as civilians in the worst blow to the Islamic Republic since the 1980s war with Iraq. Iran retaliated with barrages of missiles on Israeli military sites, infrastructure, and cities. The United States entered the war on June 22nd with strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. Trump threat. Israel, the only Middle Eastern country widely believed to have nuclear weapons, said it aimed to prevent Tehran from developing its own nuclear weapons. Iran denies having a nuclear weapons program. The UN nuclear watchdog has said it has no credible indication of an active, coordinated weapons program in Iran. Bagheri, Salami, and Hajizadeh were killed on June 13th, the first day of the war. Bagheri was being buried at the Behesht Zahra Cemetery outside Tehran mid-afternoon on June 28th. Salami and Hajizadeh were due to be buried on June 29th. President Donald Trump said on June 27th that he would consider bombing Iran again, while Khamenei, who has appeared in 2 pre-recorded video messages since the start of the war, has said Iran would respond to any future U.S. attack by striking U.S. military bases in the Middle East. A senior Israeli military official said on June 27th that Israel had delivered a major blow to Iran's nuclear project. On June 28th, Iran's Revolutionary Guard said in a statement that Israel and the United States failed to achieve their stated objectives in the war. According to Iranian health ministry figures, 610 people were killed on the Iranian side in the war before a ceasefire went into effect on June 24th. More than 4,700 were injured. Activist news agency Hirana put the number of killed at 974, including 387 civilians. Israel's health ministry said 28 were killed in Israel and 3,238 injured. And that article is entitled, Iran Holds Funeral for Slain Commanders, Scientists. Now, lastly, some news in brief from USA Today. This article is entitled, G7 Agrees to Avoid Higher Taxes for U.S. and U.K. Companies. The United States and the Group of Seven Nations have agreed to support a proposal that would exempt U.S. companies from some components of an existing global agreement, the G7 said in a statement on June 28th. The group has created a side-by-side system in response to the U.S. administration agreeing to scrap the Section 899 retaliatory tax proposal from President Donald Trump's tax and spending bill, it said in a statement from Canada, the head of the rolling G7 presidency. The G7 said the plan recognizes existing U.S. minimum tax laws and aims to bring more stability to the international tax system. UK businesses are also spared higher taxes after the removal of Section 899. Britain said businesses would benefit from greater certainty and stability following the agreement. In January, through an executive order, Trump declared that the global corporate minimum tax deal was not applicable to the United States, effectively pulling out of the landmark 2021 arrangement negotiated by the Biden administration with nearly 140 countries. That News in Brief article is entitled G7 Agrees to Higher Taxes for U.S. and U.K. Companies. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 29th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.